everyone. My name's Nick Brandt. I'm one of the senior leaders here at Circle Riders. I want to welcome you to the Circle Rider podcast. If you don't know us, we're a YWAM missional community based here in Huntington Beach, California. Our passion is Jesus. Our mission field is our generation. And we believe our opportunity is now. I want to sincerely thank you for being a part of our broader community. Enjoy this podcast.
I want to jump right in. I'm going to start by reading a letter that Brian Brandt wrote. Not the whole thing, but an excerpt. This is A Tale of Two Men. Winter, fall, spring, and summer. Winter, fall, spring, and summer. What is one season compared to another? Are they not like the second hand ticking on a clock? 1 minute piling on the next, until the day is finished. Skin worn from weather, hair damp by the rain, the tread worn on shoes, hands raw from labor. To one man, another ordinary day, another ordinary season. Time moving as it predictably does. Still, there is another man who anticipates something completely contrary to what the ordinary man perceives. They dwell in two different places, these two men, both seated in the same predictable world. The one man resigns to life as just that, life. We come to expect these kinds of things, he says. The other man sees beyond the season, beyond the hour, beyond the common. It's as if his vision transcends beyond the reflection in the mirror, beyond the daily background sounds of grumbling. Same planet, different men. Same church, same truth intake, different men. Dare I say it, and it is true. They once had the same dreams, the same hopes, even the same confidence that God moves in power. How then did the common man come into this day? He walked in the door, putting his hat upon a rack, and slowly loosens his tie as he contemplates the next moments of his life. His thoughts go no further than the smell of dinner, which will bring 15 minutes of comfort after the 10 hours that were robbed from his day. If you wonder about tomorrow, there's no need. There's simply the repeat of today, with a few twists and turns. I don't want to over-exaggerate the plight of the common man. Common is, after all, common. Have the mighty been called mighty to be sweetly encouraged by a symbolic title? Or are you indeed hand-picked by God with a purpose? The title of my message tonight is Vision That Keeps You on the Wall. I'll be preaching from Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3, where he says, Nehemiah is one of the greatest men in the Bible. He says, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Nehemiah was a man who was raised in captivity, in the Babylonian captivity in Persia. The nation of Israel had been taken over by the Babylonians as a response. Really, it was the Lord's discipline on their nation because they kept falling over and over and turning and profaning the name of God. And so he sent the Babylonians to capture them. But then the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians, and a new emperor, Artaxerxes, was reigning over the Persian Empire, and he did not know the stories of Jerusalem, that Babylon had destroyed this great city, and the reasons behind its destruction were foreign to this new ruler, and it wasn't a thing that was in his mind. All he knew was that they had these Jewish slaves and Jewish people living in their nation, of which Nehemiah was one. Now, Nehemiah wasn't just a normal man. He was no common man. He was the cupbearer to the emperor. and the job of the cupbearer, he was the most trusted person in the empire because his job was everything that went into the emperor's mouth, whether it was wine or his food, the cupbearer would taste first to ensure that it wasn't poisoned. He was a man who had gained stature because of the level of responsibility that he walked in, the level of leadership he displayed, and he had risen to this level of notoriety within the king's court. The amazing thing about Nehemiah, some scholars say that he single-handedly saved Judaism from being wiped off the face of the planet, or from being extinguished or becoming altogether insignificant. The book of Nehemiah is the final piece of history that we have before the 400 years of silence before Jesus comes on the scene. God sent Nehemiah as the final man to restore Israel so that there would be a nation that the Messiah could be born to. Now, Nehemiah was doing his duty on a regular basis, and he was serving the emperor, and he was always a man who had a bright countenance. He was filled with joy, and he was very good at his job. But one day, his brother came to him and shared some news. I'll go there and read really quickly. This is Nehemiah chapter 1. Now, it happened that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the exile. Now, mind you, they're about 70 years in, most scholars think, to the exile. So we know about Nehemiah, he's never seen Jerusalem. He's never seen Israel. All he knows is that he has this identity as a Jew and that his family was once living in this great city of Jerusalem. But now, imagine the identity of a captive whose city has been destroyed and who has no nation. He says, I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and I mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes be open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel. We have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We've acted corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments and statutes. Remember your word that you commanded. You said, I will scatter you among the peoples, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. And he goes on to ask the Lord to allow him to restore the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. So he goes into the king's court to do his job this day, and he's downcast. He has been fasting, he's been weeping, and for the first time, the emperor saw him not on his best. And the emperor looks at him and says, why are you so sad? What's going on? And then Nehemiah goes to explain to him, and he says, the good hand of my God was upon me because I found favor in the sight of the king. And the king grants him everything he needs to go back to Jerusalem. He asks him, will you allow me to be released to go rebuild the walls? And then when the king says yes, he says, then can you also send with me the timber that I need to build the gates and people to go with me and the soldiers to protect us? He gets all of his wishes granted. And he ends up going back to Jerusalem and seeing the destruction of the city, and his heart is grieved. And you've got to imagine seeing a city that was destroyed. It's hard for us to imagine. But it says that the houses were in ruin, the wall was broken down, and the stones were burned, and the gates were burned by fire. But Nehemiah undertakes the great task when it's not his responsibility. He wasn't the king. He had no royal blood. It was not incumbent upon him to be the solution to this problem in Israel. But he was willing to be the solution. In the face of impossible odds. So he begins to rebuild the wall, and he executes with some of the greatest leadership that we see displayed in the scriptures, the massive undertaking of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And the enemies in the surrounding nations start to get intimidated, because Jerusalem, if it was repaired, would be such a formidable opponent, and all of these nations have grown to enjoy not having the strength of Israel there. And so they try to intimidate, and they start to say things to, they start to diminish, and they send these messages. It says, now when Sanballat, this is chapter 4, heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. He said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? And Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, yes, what are they building? If a fox goes up on the wall, he'll break down the whole thing. Hear our God, for we are despised, Nehemiah says. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. So they're coming as they're building the wall, and they're taunting them and they're jeering at them and they're diminishing them. And it doesn't work. They keep working. And there's this epic story. I don't have time to go into the book of Nehemiah. And let me tell you, this book preaches. My goodness. If we had some time, there would be some things to unpack in here. But I want to focus on this one key phrase, Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3. Because what happens is they begin to near completion, and the enemies realize they're not going to be able to intimidate them. So they changed their tactic, and they said, why don't we entice them? Maybe offer some kind of meeting, because we're the governors of the surrounding nations, so maybe he'll be inclined to come meet with us. And we don't know what they had planned there, but you can imagine it was assassination or abduction or some plan like that. But they come, and they come to Nehemiah, and it says they send him a message saying, come, let us meet together in the plain of Ono. But they intended to do me harm, and I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent to me 4 times in this way. Nehemiah said, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. My question for you tonight is, do you have a great work? Or rather, what is your great work? Do you have a vision for your life that keeps you focused? Do you have a vision that keeps you on the wall? Do you have the ability to say no to lesser things because your eyes are set on the future of what God has called you to? Do you have a vision? Who are you becoming? Do you see your life as a great work? Maybe some here don't. Maybe some would resonate with the plight of the common man, one day into the next, 1 minute piling upon another. There is an old man or an old woman that's down inside of you. and they're depending on you. Not to waste your youth. Don't disappoint them by being foolish in your years of strength. Living for no purpose. Do you have a great work? Do you have a vision that keeps you on the wall? What is your wall? What is the state of your wall right now? Is it broken down? Maybe like Nehemiah, you're inheriting a broken wall. If the wall is your life, if the wall is the thing that God has called you to, the purpose that he's prepared in advance for you, maybe, I don't know your background, maybe your wall, before you can think about the Crusades and the millions, maybe your wall is going to be a faithful marriage. Maybe your wall looks a little bit more like integrity before it looks like reaching the masses. Maybe some of you broke down your own wall. Or maybe someone else broke it down. And you had nothing that you could do about it. When I was getting married in the first couple years of my amazing wife Yasmin and I's marriage, we were preparing to have kids. And I didn't feel ready. I wanted kids. I've been wanting kids my entire life since I was a teenager and I started following Jesus. I was like, man, I can't wait to be a father. But then all of a sudden when I got married, I was like, whoa, I don't know if I can do this. And I sat down and I was with the Lord just saying, why this thing that I've been excited about my whole life, why do I feel afraid? And I realized it's because There was no way that I had to pass down. There wasn't the Pierce way. I heard Brian talking to his sons one time, and they were mentioning some moment that happened, some difficult scenario, and Brian said, no, this is the Brent way. This is how we handle this situation. And I was just, you know, in the room, but something hit me and I realized there's no Pierce way. That's a wall I have to build. And once I realized that, all of a sudden things came into focus. And it took me a few months, a couple of years of intentionality, but I finally felt ready. And then once that shift happened, felt like I had built up the wall. I was like, I'm so ready to have a son. Proverbs 28:19 says, where there is no vision, the people perish. Where there's no vision, the people perish. And really what we're talking about here is vision. Nehemiah had a great work and it was his vision that kept him on the wall. Because you see, the funny thing about Nehemiah's work was his actual work wasn't great. Have you ever, I don't know if anybody's ever seen a wall being built. My father was a stonemason, so I partook in a lot of wall building throughout my childhood. And we would be mixing mortar. I don't know if anybody's ever mixed mortar. Anybody done manual labor in here? I know we live in Orange County, so maybe not. But I'm like, how am I going to raise my son here? What in the world? I grew up in a small mountain town in Georgia. Sorry, I wasn't trying to insult you, but we'll find a way. But we grew up mixing the mortar. It's hard work. You're sweating. Your back hurts. You've got all the sand and the stuff in the wheelbarrow, and you've got the hoe, and you're just going for hours. And then you're putting the mortar on the bricks, and you're picking up the stack of bricks and putting it on the wall. It's not sexy. That's what Nehemiah was doing. And you're like, that's your great work? Really? Sweating all day under the sun? Working? Mixing mortar? Putting together bricks that were broken? But the great work wasn't mixing the mortar. It wasn't putting the brick on the wall. His great work was restoring the city of Jerusalem. But what that looked like was hard work. But he was looking at bricks, but he was seeing a nation. He was looking at mortar, but he was seeing a city. What do you see when you look at your life? We got to ask ourselves these questions. I want to define vision. Vision directs your thoughts, your dreams, and your expectations higher. Vision pulls you into a new reality where what was impossible becomes impossible. When you cast vision, what people couldn't see before, they now can see. And they have the ability to bring something that's not reality into manifestation because of vision. Vision creates hope and it inspires people. It inspires you to invest and to sacrifice. Vision is the beautiful alternative. It's the thing that's different from what you see right now. It's what could be rather than what is. It's the peak of the mountain that you can see from a distance. It's the place you want to end up where things will be different than they are now. Vision is what keeps you going in the difficult moments, the most difficult moments of your journey. Vision is the reason why you wake up in the morning. Do you have it? The enemy is after your vision. Maybe some of you once had vision, but you've lost it. Maybe some of you have come close, but couldn't catch it. Maybe some of you have never even been able to see. What you see affects who you are. And the enemy, there's so many strategies he's used, but I want to talk about a couple of things. You know, pornography, what it does to your brain is completely remolds it as if you were taking heroin or cocaine. It drives the pleasure center of your mind, which is in the side of your brain. It strengthens it to the point where it overrides your decision-making ability. You make decisions up here, you respond to impulses right here. And when you, just like when you do drugs, when you look at pornography, what's happening is every single time your brain is being washed with chemicals that are weakening and literally deforming the front of your brain. The enemy is after your vision. Because what you see affects who you are. You know, I'm just going to throw out a random number, but sorry if this is going to be intense, but we're just going in. 2 hours a week viewing pornography becomes 4 entire days a year. 4 days out of your year. At the end of 10 years, that's 45 days of your life that have been spent just viewing pornography. Think about that, how that affects somebody. 45 days straight. Without breaks. That's like 45 consecutive hours. Morning, noon, and night. Think what that does to somebody. How it might affect their vision. And people who really have a stronghold of pornography in their life spend a lot more than 2 hours a week. I want to talk about screen time for a second. Just because we're Gen Z and millennials in here. This is a survey that was done of Gen Z that was broad and sweeping. This is the amount of time Gen Z has spent on the phone. Over 60% of Gen Z spends 4 hours or more per day on their phone. How many would say you're around there somewhere? 4 hours? Maybe you don't want to raise your hand. That's okay. Thank you for being honest. A lot more of you are honest than I expected. That's good. Okay. Remember, the enemy is after your vision. Over 60% spend 4 hours or more each day. Let's do some math. That's 28 hours a week, which means already at the end of a week, you've spent one day of your entire week plus some change just consecutively on your phone. An entire day out of your 7 days. This comes up to 124 hours a month or 5 days of a month. So that's 5 days of your entire month on the phone. 1,460 hours a year, or 60.8, let's just round it up to 61 days a year, or 2 months of your life every year looking at your phone. Once a year, 2 months of your year. Now, over the next 10 years of your life, that'll be equivalent to 2 years. Two of the next 10 years of your life, you're double tithing to your phone. Your time. Some of you don't even tithe. I'm just kidding. Got him. Now, over the next, I had to bring some comic relief. You guys were getting depressed. I saw your faces. Some of you are crying. Okay. It's okay. Cry it out. That's why I'm doing this. I'm just kidding. Okay. Now, over the next 50 years of your life, which is really what we're living for, right? You're not living for tomorrow. You're not living for the next 10 years even. I don't know about you. I'm living for 50 years from now. Are you? Can we agree on that tonight? Living for 50 years from now? That's up to 10 years of your life over the next 50 years spent on your phone. I'm just getting a mental break. I'm just tuning out for a second. Becomes 10 years gone with nothing to show. Nothing to show for it. Maybe a little bit better sense of humor because of all the memes. But you can get that without spending 10 years. You have to have vision. You've got to have vision that keeps you on the wall. See, for Nehemiah, it was people coming to him and sending letters and taunting him. For you, it's in your pocket. Come down just for a minute. Ten years. It's 4 hours a day. I'm doing a great work. And I cannot come down. What do you really want? Jesus himself said these words, "Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened. Ask and you will receive." What's your vision? What do you want? What are you asking for? Are you asking for anything? Are you knocking? I want to talk about what happens when we don't have vision just for a minute. Without vision, there is no coherence to your actions, because vision is the overarching thing that brings all that you do together. It is impossible to make a wise decision without having a life vision. Your vision is what guides you into wisdom, because how can you possibly know if something is a good decision for your life or not if you don't know where you're going? And what happens when you don't have vision is there's no coherence to your life, because this seems like a good idea and this seems like a good idea and this is what I want to do and I kind of thought about this one time, and then before you know it, you're spread all over the place and you've got no continuity and no coherence, so then you become anxious, and then in your anxiety, you cope. And then in your coping, you become depressed, and in your depression, you become hopeless. Vision brings a coherence to your life, but anxiety marks incoherency. If you've got no long-term goal, that means you've got no hope, because hope is always connected to the big picture vision, the ability to see beyond the now. That's what hope is, and you've got to have hope. We don't preach about hope enough. We preach a lot about faith and love. But hope is the essential of the is an essential of those three. Deep and abiding meaning in your daily life comes from having vision. You could become somebody great. Did you know that? You've got everything you need inside of you to become great. Your life is a great work. Do you see it that way? Do you see it that way? And I'm not just talking about your accomplishments. I'm talking about who you are. Some people in this room, you've never had anybody tell you that. You could be great. You could be great. Why couldn't you? Come debate me right now. You'll lose. Maybe you have a wrong perception of what greatness could be. We could talk about that. Maybe we see greatness as something that we've elevated it in our modern Christianity to be on the stage. There's way too many prophecies. I'm getting ahead of myself right now. But there's way too many prophecies that I think we prophesy out of the flesh about greatness. I don't want to be the next Moses. I just want to be a good father. Sure, maybe you are going to be a voice to your generation, but can you first be a good husband? Do you have vision for who you're becoming? Have you thought about this? What kind of a husband will you be? What kind of a father will you be? What kind of a mother will you be? What will your children say about you when they're adults? Talk about life vision. What do you want your kids to say about you when they are adults and you're not in the room? That'll give you some life vision right there. Maybe you can start, don't have the pressure to have this big overarching thing, but try saying my vision for my life is I want to be honest. I want to be someone who's honest. I want to be someone who can be trusted. How about that for a life vision, for a start? I want to be someone who can be trusted with a hard job or trusted with the task of leadership. That right there, that's 10 years. That vision, that one sentence, I want to be the kind of person who can be trusted with leadership. That's the next 10 years of your life becoming that, because that means a lot of things. That's a great place to start. And you'll end up in a much better place than the person who said their vision was to reach 1 million people but wasn't worried about becoming trusted. They may never reach 1 million people. Maybe they will on social media. But what influence really is that? Are all those people going to be at their funeral? Are they even going to notice that they're not posting anymore? I'm talking about real influence. Do you have it? Vision will take you there. There's a phrase that we say a lot in our generation, you're perfect just the way that you are. But that is a damning phrase. Because it immediately discounts who you're becoming. Does it mean that you've arrived? You're perfect just the way that you are. We say that because we don't want people to feel bad, but in doing that, we sacrifice who you could be. You're not perfect just the way that you are. And real self-love, real self-care, is envisioning yourself as somebody that unfolds over time. You've got to love the 50-year-old version of yourself by recognizing that you are not all that you could be right now. And there is pain in that. That's hard. It hurts. But it's what creates the opportunity for vision. Having the realization that you are not who you could be is what could drive you into becoming great. Maybe some people in this room, you're the opposite. You've only ever thought that you're great. You've still got some room to grow, buddy. And And we have such a pressure right now, and especially because we're spending these, I mean, let's go back to the 4 hours a day on the phone. What are you actually looking at? You're looking at something that is like heaping pressure on you, or you're just watching mind-numbing reels, one or the other. But in between the mind-numbing reels and the gifts and the memes is the 28-year-old millionaire, the 25-year-old with the private jet, standing in front of a yacht or going to the club or whatever it may be, which is the highlight reel. It's not even reality. It's totally fake. But we see there's such a pressure. There's a greater pressure on this generation than there ever has been in human history for you to be a millionaire by the time you're 30. You scroll past it and you're like, how did I afford this trip to Thailand? By the 19 rentals that I own that produce $6,500 a month in cash flow. I'm 23 years old. And you're like, I suck. I have negative $6,500 a month in cash flow. What am I doing? And I'm 6 years behind this kid. Gosh. It's a performance mentality, but the reality is right now, did you know that only 1% of Americans are millionaires and 75% of them are over the age of 50? So you need to take the pressure off yourself, okay? Who are you becoming? Maybe you'll become a millionaire, but think about who you're becoming before you think about the successes that you're going to have. Because the who you're becoming will lead you into successes that you could not imagine. But if all you chase is success, and you'll get there, and your integrity will not be able to handle it. And that is a scary place to be. We are all in this room. We're all still in the development phase. So you've got some time. So how then should your internal conversation be? What should it be? Because if you're like me, sometimes your internal conversation can be prone to negativity a little bit. I'm too far behind. Maybe some people in this room, even it's a normal thing on a daily basis to cuss at yourself in your head. Maybe you wouldn't say it out loud, but you say it inside. You need to take the pressure off yourself. Who put that there? Who put that on you? It wasn't Jesus. It wasn't Jesus. The 4 hours a day put that there. The enemy put that there because he's after your vision. Because if he can get you incapacitated by pressure, then you'll never be able to come up for a breath of fresh air long enough to think about who you're becoming rather than what you'll accomplish. I want to talk about the difference between internal and external vision. Internal vision is when you think, it's what I've been saying this whole time, it's who are you becoming. External vision is what I'm going to do. It's good to have external vision. You should. You ought to. It should drive you forward. I've got a lot of things in my external vision, but they've been developed over time once I felt I had a solid foundation of who I wanted to become and where I was headed in my life. And there's a problem I want to address that I think specifically relates to us in this room, and it's the problem of giftedness and anointing. Because what giftedness does is it hides your lack of internal vision. Anointing hides the fact that you are not intentionally becoming somebody. Because every time you get up there, everybody says, wow, you're amazing, good job, that was awesome. Because you always crush it, because you perform really well. And maybe it is sincere, I'm not saying that you're fake, but what I am saying is it's dangerous. Being anointed and gifted, which a lot of people in this room are, is a dangerous thing because you can create an exception mentality where you count yourself out from the standards of Scripture because you're anointed or because of the words that God has spoken over your life. Your calling is so big. Don't you know how many people you're going to impact? Don't you know already the impact you've had? So it's okay if I glance a couple times. It's okay if I send a few DMs because I'm anointed. God will forgive me and I can still blow it up tomorrow night. Ministry success is not God's affirmation of your secret sin. We We have ministry success and then private lives that are different than what's on the stage because we lack internal vision. Maybe you've got external vision. Maybe they prophesied over you. Maybe you got called out by the prophet, by the man or woman of God, and they said how amazing you're going to be and all the people you're going to reach and the things God's going to do through your life. But no one sat down with you and taught you how to be a man. And sometimes we look at the amazing encounters, but we elevate them over the hard work of development, of being discipled, of reading books, of getting counseling. We elevate the prophetic word in the service over going to get counseling for healing from legitimate trauma in your life that is going to lead you into a life of addiction if you don't deal with it. But we chase the prophetic moments because we don't have internal vision. Sometimes we overcomplicate. We get these huge words and we have these massive things of pressure, but we are not able to do the simple things that will lead you to the big picture vision. Think of Abraham, father of many nations. Your descendants will outnumber the stars in the sky. That's pretty huge, right? But the first thing to Abraham is, okay, how about just becoming a father first? Or for you, how about just becoming the type of person who could be a father? The type of person who a woman could look at and say, that's a man that I would like to raise my kids. Become that kind of a man before worrying about fulfilling the prophetic word of, you know, being a spiritual father to many nations or whatever. Don't wait for a sovereign calling. Become somebody great. Elisha was plowing in the field, but that didn't mean he was a farmer. He was plowing, he was giving himself to the work, but he didn't know he was a prophet. And he didn't know that he would go on to become the greatest prophet in the Old Testament, whose miracles were only rivaled by Jesus and the apostles. Until greatness came by him and he saw it. But before that, he was diligently plowing in the field, being prepared for who he was going to become. I'm running out of time, so I want to move ahead here. Proverbs 25:28 says, a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Going back to Jerusalem, broken down and left without walls. Imagine a city with the ability to be attacked at any moment with no defense. That's what it says a person without self-control is like. What's going to give you self-control? The ability to look beyond the temptation of the moment to who you're becoming. Yes, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control, all those things, but I'm talking about the day-to-day discipline. How are you going to say no when they come? When I was 16, I was asking my mentor for some advice because I was struggling. I had a few cycles of sin in my life. I had... it was hard for me to, this is so silly, maybe some of you can relate. It was hard for me to stay awake during my quiet times. I was 16 and I would just wake up early to spend time with Jesus, but I'd find myself dozing off. And I went to my mentor and I said, can you help me? Why can't I get free from these things? And why can't I stay awake? And he looked at me and I will never forget this moment. He looked me dead in the face and he says, you do not have a wall. And he looked at me and he said, Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3 says, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. You have no great work. That's why you can fall asleep. That's why you can't get free. There's nothing driving you forward. Then he said, think about, he literally said this to me. He said, think about your grandchildren for a few minutes. That's your wall. What are you going to hand them? What's the legacy that they'll receive? I want to ask the band to come up here. Bring this into a close and we can respond. But in closing, I want to ask you a question that I asked in the beginning. What is your wall? What's the state of your wall right now? You know, one thing that I love about the story of Nehemiah rebuilding the wall is when they were taunting him, they said, what are they going to use, those burnt stones? But God didn't have a problem with them using burnt stones to rebuild the wall. The burnt stones were the mark of the pain, the mark of the pillaging and the rape of their city. That's what the burnt stones were. The burnt stones were the image of the destruction that the enemy had brought on them. It was their shame, it says. Those who live in the city are in shame. But God took those burnt stones and built a wall. What about your burnt stones? What about your wall? Is it broken down? Are you inheriting a broken wall? And maybe some of us, when we're thinking about our wall and thinking about who we could become, it feels like your vision is clogged, like you can't see. It's hard to imagine who you could be, what greatness actually is in you. And I just want to say that it probably is because you've been so inundated with the world's vision for your life. You've lost the perspective of heaven. You guys can start playing behind me. I'm going to wrap it up in a second. We've been inundated with the values of the world. The enemy has taken all the different versions of what the vision of your life could be that are maybe good, but are they great? And he's shoved them in our face. And what we need to do is cry out to God for his perspective. Some people in this room, literally tonight, the first thing you need to do is repent for having a lower vision. You need to ask God's forgiveness for looking at the wrong thing, for having your eyes set low. And you need to set them on Jesus. Jesus is the vision. Hebrews 12, 1 through 3 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he is seated at the right hand of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Our vision is Jesus. Look to him, and his vision was you. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He was thinking of you. You were the joy set before him. You and the delight of his Father were the things that were keeping him moving forward up that hill. So I want to ask if we can all stand tonight. First thing I want to do is invite us in. I'm going to ask the band to lead us in a chorus or a response. to set our vision off of this lower reality and onto the vision of heaven. Would you allow Jesus to clean? It's literally like him cleaning your eyes. Like if you have goggles, it's like wiping the grime off those goggles so you can actually see. Can you see? Can you see who he wants you to become? Can you see the kind of father that you could be? Can you see the kind of husband or mother or wife, the kind of leader, the kind of friend, the kind of brother, the kind of son, the kind of daughter that you could be, the kind of leader? Can you see it? So I want to ask us right now across the room to begin to pray, to open our mouths. And I want to cry, to lift up in this place, to cry out to God saying, Jesus, would you cleanse my vision? Cleanse my eyes. Cleanse my mind. Some of you have been inundated with pornographic images and you literally need Jesus to set you free and to heal your eyes and your mind. So I want to ask a cry to raise up. Would you begin to pray, Jesus, pray with me. Just pray in your own words, but pray with me. Jesus, would you lift my vision higher? Would you lift my vision higher, God? Would you cleanse my vision? Change my perspective, God. I've been inundated with the world's vision for my life. I've settled for something lower. I've settled for something less. God, would you change me? Change me. Come on, cry out to God tonight. Cry out to God tonight. He wants to show you. He loves you. He wants to show you. He wants to show you who you could be. He wants to show you who you could become.
Give me fresh vision.
Maybe you didn't have a vision of a father because you didn't have one. He wants to give you his perspective.
Give me fresh vision, Lord.
Thank you, Jesus. Come on, let's keep crying out to God.
I want to know you. I want to see you. I want to know who you are. Give me fresh vision, Lord. Give me fresh vision. Lord, I want to know you, I want to see you, I want to know who you are. Give me fresh vision, Lord. Give me fresh vision, Lord. I want to know you, I want to see you, I want to know who you are.
Lord, don't let me be common. Come on, someone needs to pray that out. Don't let me be common. I don't want the plight of the common man. Far be it from me to live a common existence. God, lift my vision higher. I want to live with purpose. I want to live with purpose. Some people just need to pray out and ask God to forgive you for making it complicated. You've got this big grand vision of your life, of all this ministry success or whatever, these words that have been spoken over you, and it's incapacitated you with pressure. And you just need to lay it at his feet and take the first step into becoming somebody. Don't worry about fulfilling the words over your life. Just co-labor with Jesus to become someone who could fulfill those words. Become the woman who could fulfill those words. Don't try to fulfill them yourself. Some of you need to pray this. You can pray it in your own word, in your own words, but I'll just pray it. Lord, I'm sorry for making it complicated. I've been frozen because I made it complicated. I put too much pressure on myself. I can't make decisions because I'm afraid. Lord, give me vision. that brings clarity. God is bringing clarity to you right now. Ask him for clarity. Jesus, would you give me clarity in simplicity? Say, Lord, I'm sorry for making it complicated. I want to be simple. How about a vision to love him with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength? Can you be the kind of man who could love him with everything? How about that for a vision to start? Jesus, I want to love you with everything.
Thanks for listening to a Circuit Rider podcast. For our full library of podcasts and more information about the Circuit Riders, visit us at circuitriders.com. To access worship, messages, and training courses, visit us at circuitriders.tv. To get involved with the day-to-day of what we do or see what's happening across the globe, you can follow us at Circuit Riders on Instagram. And finally, don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll see you next time.